really all that you see. In other words, there's no additional energies that come out of ceramics, metals, steels, manganese, magnets. There's no additional energy that comes out. It's just basically whatever you put in and heat. At least this is, and I have a lot of experience in this area, Wesley. I'm going to pass it back to Dick first, then over to John. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
So you've seen no evidence of any kind of transmutation of one element into another element because of a rapidly varying sinusoidal or non-sinusoidal. Many of the waveforms you work with are non-sinusoidal, rich in harmonics. So you've put all kinds of frequencies into all kinds of materials. You've seen magnetic effects, you've seen saturation effects, you've seen heating effects, but you've seen no other magic. Now, Wesley might say that, well, you weren't looking for it. There may have been other things taking place, and you didn't know to look for it. You happened not to have a Geiger counter there while you were doing this. I'm moderately sure that the Geiger counter would not, if properly shielded, respond. And you got to worry about a Geiger counter. One of the things I've worried about is that if you're putting RF energy into a substance near a Geiger counter, the way the Geiger counter works, if it's a Geiger-Mullen tube, is that there's a high-voltage anode inside of a cylindrical object with an inert gas inside, and when a nuclear particle penetrates the Geiger-Mullen tube, it does instantaneous ionization. It makes a click in the current sensed in the Geiger-Mullen tube, and the amplifier amplifies that current, rectifies it, sends it to a meter, and maybe send some of it to a loudspeaker. So there's a characteristic sound clicking, characteristic meter movement that you get with real nuclear materials on that Geiger-Mullen tube. Let me drop.
But Dick, can I just add another note to this? There's another key to radio energy to higher frequency energy, like you're talking about, like Geiger counter, that kind of measurements. And if you can let me have a few words here.
I'll finish this sentence, and that was that the amplification process in the presence of strong magnetic field, if you didn't have perfect shielding on the amplifier of the Geiger counter, the presence of RF could give you an indication on the meter that is non-nuclear, even though the whole thing is called Geiger counter. And under those circumstances, it is my belief that if you were listening with a loudspeaker, you would hear a characteristic difference of the sound made by an RF wave compared to a real nuclear device being picked up by the Geiger tube. So there's a difference there, but you got to worry that RF energy into a Geiger counter could give you a false alarm. KC2QIQ, K2RW, go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, absolutely about the false alarm on that one. Here's another thing. Typically, when you talk about high energy, nuclear, X-ray, things of that nature, excluding light and tungsten to be something separate. But in other words, typically when you're talking about X-rays and that type of energy that you'll see, typically you need voltage to do that. In other words, like even if you're going to accelerate an X-ray tube, you need, kilovolts. So in other words, some voltage, a very, very high voltage, but that has really nothing to do with the ferrite. It's just voltage applied on tungstens and all those kinds of materials where you can create focal spots of X-ray and things of that nature, but you need very, very high voltages. So you're up in way, the 40 kV and above level before you're going to see that, before you're going to get any kind of that kind of radiation available. So here again, the typical types of voltages, even at hundreds of volts on ferrites and RF voltages, I mean, you'd need, in order at 50 ohms or an RF wave to get to those kinds of voltages, it would be a very heroic experience, if you know what I'm saying, Dick, because the amount of loss involved.
Yeah, in the case of an X-ray tube, the X-ray machine that works at my dentist office, I think it's running on something close to 50,000 volts, and the X-rays are not nuclear. It's just an extremely short wavelength of electromagnetic energy is what that X-ray is. You start off with a high enough voltage inside of an X-ray tube, and you are generating a kind of a signal generator that makes very short wavelengths. That is not a nuclear event. Yeah, there are there are nuclear materials that will spontaneously degrade. The right kind of uranium and plutonium, for instance, has partially unstable nucleuses, nuclei, that are emitting particles, real nuclear particles come flying out of there at close to the speed of light. For you to reverse that process to do transmutation, for you to decide, I want to add a proton or I want to add a neutron to the molecules, to the elements, to the, elements or molecules of this substance, the amount of effort required to force that proton, to go into that nucleus, it's huge. Without a particle accelerator, in the past, no one's been able to do it. Many people want to believe that there are techniques by which cold fusion can take place, that the palladium and other materials that when doped just right is going to do some kind of squeezing of proton into that nucleus at the atomic level. And for Fleischmann and Pons, starting way back in 1989, I think it was, thought they had discovered cold fusion. And lots of laboratories have tried to duplicate that result with not much success so far. It's a great wish.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
The international ignition device out in California, where we're putting, I'm pretty sure it's billions of dollars into these very high power lasers in order to try to create fusion by way of inertial confinement. And we're talking about machines that are multiple house sizes in order to do it. The main point I've got is that to force anything into the nucleus of that atom, you would be amazed how difficult it is. Not only is it extremely strong in charge and resist your effort, it is an extremely strong target. You take an atom of, let's say, hydrogen and helium, and you blow it up to the size of a town, 2.5 miles in diameter. That's the outer diameter of this helium atom that I have blown up in size just to investigate it. The nucleus inside of that 2.5 mile diameter atom of helium, the nucleus is the size of a golf ball, 1.6 inches in diameter out of 2.5 miles. And you're trying to get something to get into that extremely strong, small target, and it's got extremely strong charge resisting your effort. And, wow, it ain't easy is my point. John, I know you wanted to make a comment on this. So what I'm saying is that we got to go a little bit slow on any of the claims of a nuclear event or a cold fusion event. Right now, the history says it's hard to believe it once you understand at the molecular level what's required to do it. I didn't say it's impossible. I'm just saying it's awfully, awfully difficult. So we got to go a little bit slow. And so I know that after I talk to John, we're going to pass it back to Wes. I know that Wes is in the process of duplicating some of these machines that he has seen. And so he, in theory, if he's able to...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
If Wes is able to buy and borrow enough instrumentation, and every time we buy instrumentation, I don't care if it's even a handheld calculator. It takes you a while to really learn how to use it, to really make it do all of its tricks. So it's going to take Wes... Unless Wes has got an IQ of 1,000, it's going to take him a while to learn the ins and outs of all the instrumentation. But as he acquires the right instrumentation to make these measurements, at least we will have a way of confirming or denying what we think is taking place. It's very difficult to envision some kind of a magic process takes place by which you're absolutely unable to make a measurement. Almost every scientist who thinks it's impossible to measure eventually finds out that it was just limited thinking. With enough spots, almost anything can be measured. Almost. John, KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Yes, Dick, well, you and Glenn just covered the question about the energy. That's what I was going to ask you. And also, I know that in nature we have transmutation, such as uranium turning into lead over a long period of time. But I don't believe that can happen with an RF energy and exposing a piece of steel to it and have it change into something else. I don't believe that's possible. I have not seen it done. I know there are claims, but I didn't hear Glenn say anything about that. But and I know he wasn't looking for that, but I'd be interested in that too. Okay, Dick, back to you. That was my question, which you already covered.
Yeah, natural spontaneous emission of an unstable molecule like plutonium and uranium and a few others, the fact that they will spontaneously emit and very slowly over, in many cases, thousands of years, some of those atoms will be converted to a, by a fission-like process, they will be converted to a lower element on the periodic table. To my knowledge, except for what goes on in the center of a star, Mother Nature almost never walks up the periodic table. She almost always walks down in a natural process that you and I can carry on in the laboratory. She wants to walk down. She doesn't want to walk up. And even in the center of the sun, which in some cases has got thousands and millions of solar masses of energy, of mass with tremendous amounts of pressure, the center of the sun, an ordinary mediocre star, has something like 10 million degrees Fahrenheit, 10 million atmospheres, crushing those hydrogen atoms together to make them into helium atoms and producing the nuclear fusion that's powering that sun. And the sun is getting a tremendous amount of energy, but the resources required for it to do it, wow. And yeah, the sun is walking up the periodic table, and when it gets to iron, it's game over. And nickel is beyond iron, unfortunately, nickel toward copper. So other than what goes on inside of the sun, which really is one hell of a particle accelerator, is one way of looking at particle crusher, particle heater, and particle accelerator. And we're talking about 100 million degrees here. Other than that, Mother Nature doesn't walk up the periodic table. She walks down, and even the walk down. I mean, if you waited for oxygen to turn into nitrogen, not in the age of this universe will that happen. Oxygen is much too stable.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Some of the really big, heavy molecules like plutonium and uranium, yes, they're nuclear-wise, partially unstable, and emit. But even the lower items on the periodic table, if they were going to move at all, they would move down, but they don't even do that. So transmutation, I mean, the alchemists of old really wanted to turn lead into gold. It turns out turning gold into lead is easier. There's been jokes about that, but lots of people are looking for it, and it's not easy. Now that we know a little bit more of the physics involved in the cross-sectional areas of the target and the degree of difficulty of getting to the target, there are X-ray machines running at 100,000 volts, nowhere near enough voltage to create a nuclear event. It makes very short, very hard X-rays. That's an electromagnetic wave, very short wavelength. That's not a nuclear event. We call it nuclear magnetic resonance, which goes on in an MRI machine. But is that machine capable of doing transmutation? I doubt it. But I'm going to try to keep an open mind on this. So, as you can tell, Wes, I know you're in the process of duplicating this. Make us a guess, and maybe you don't want to, and that's perfectly all right. When do you believe you'll be making a measurement that presents some data where you can say, I started off with this number of grams of material, that many watts of RF energy, and I'm getting out this many watts of energy out of the machine, greater than what's going in. I know you're looking for a nice, usable source of energy for the United States. And it's a desirable sounding goal. I know it's a very difficult goal. There are other people who have been where you are, and a good number of them haven't succeeded. You've got more resources than the average guy, internationally speaking. I know you've got contacts all over the world.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
And you have personally, with your own eyes, seen some of these demonstrations. And on the assumption that what you saw and what was really happening was accurate, they certainly sound interesting. But the fact that we haven't yet heard many of them as a commercial product is a bit disappointing. But maybe now with Mr. Rossi, that's going to change. Into XJM, K2RIW in the TechNet.
At first I see connection between Andrea Rossi and my experiment. Andrea Rossi says that he's got that secret ingredients, and he used the aluminum about the foil. He used Ludlum, the variac meter, very much similar to the one that I got from John. And the relation about the calorimetry in terms of heat conservation was put to the point that the use of aluminum foil makes only sense if you want to stop the beta radiation. And because Mr. Rossi he's applying for the patent, it looks like Edison, Hundershot, and Coleman were practically doing very much similarly the same. But go to the concrete. One of the German scientists who approached me, he said that he believes that EM environment affects the stability of entire atom. And the wavelength of the proton is short enough, it can cause ionization of the atom, or it can cause the radioactive decay of the nucleus. And it does not really have to be a radioactive compound, as I use. Non-radioactive compound. The photon of one full wavelength has also the angstroms to be in the angstroms. So along with the wavelength, the intensity of the wave has to be increased to at least the sum of the effects. If I was giving 400 megahertz roughly in change to the compound, and the alpha, beta, gamma, whatever the radiation could be there, is much out of the spectrum, then we may assume that I'm simply in error. Nothing is happening. I see something that doesn't exist. Let me drop. But when I remove the power, and then I see slow decay, the longest time that I've seen decay was 27 seconds. There was the slow decaying emission. And of course it was properly measured, at least as much properly as I could. And you're right, I had to learn a lot. But it looks like Andrea Rossi's secret formula is not secret any longer. But that's my assumption. You might have a different opinion of it. Terrific Energy Conversion Technology is a company in the United States. It's a petabot in Hudson based company that it does have a nuclear battery that's ready for sale. It is based on beta photovoltaic, so it's a beta ray. It has high efficiency. I'm reading from direct energy conversion. Green and safe. No harmful radiation, leaching, or contamination. Which I confirm because this device works like a ghost. When it stops working at zero level, nothing happens. Nothing is contaminating. Long life. About 12 to 100 years. Well, Coleman said 70 years. Scarborough, white from factor variety, extreme environment 100 degrees to 150 degrees. Manufacturable is based on semiconductor techniques. Then when I go to another one, nanobatteries, I see similar information. When I go to beta voltaics, I see similar information. When I go to tritium, tritium is radioactive isotope of hydrogen The nucleus of tritium, sometimes called triton, contains one proton and two neutrons, whereas the neutron of protium, but by the far most abundant hydrogen isotope. Now we see the certain similarity to Andrea Rossi in here, but how do we get that? The tritium is being produced in nature, but is extremely rare. It could be also produced in nuclear reactors by neutron activation of lithium-6. And this is possible with the neutrons of energy and in the exothermic reaction yielding 4.8 megavolt. So now, yes, everything is exactly like you both saying. You gotta use the energy in order to get the energy. But in the situation of lithium experiment, I've seen the device working, and the maximum power extraction that was made at that time with two generators delivering milliwatts of power was 1 kilowatt of power. I didn't see 1 kilowatt, but I saw 600 watts at maximum for a short period of time. And then after that, the ferrite was changing the properties too much for us to be able to follow, as the generator we have had was maximum 2 megahertz. Entering GM.
I think in some of these experiments, the experimenter would like to be able to turn on some kind of a reasonable sized apparatus, not something the size of a particle accelerator, and have the ability to tell the nucleus of this particular material, I want you to spontaneously change at this time, fuse or fission or fusion, for you to, and even if you have started off with a radioactive material, which is doing a natural radioactive decay, and from the outside world you tell it, I want you to speed up or slow down. That is extremely difficult. Just by turning on some kind of high voltage, without, you know, a huge particle accelerator, that's not going to do it. Turning on a high-frequency signal generator, I don't think that's going to do it. Heat, cold, acceleration. That nucleus is an extremely persnickety, hard, small thing that has a mind of its own, held together by the strong force. And if you decide that you want to violate the strong force and you want to change that nucleus in some way, it's extremely difficult. So the size of the apparatus that you and I have seen in these YouTube videos, Wes, doesn't show me that it has the millions and millions of volts. Yes, the Van de Graaff generator, by way of producing millions of volts, did do a kind of particle accelerating that did do a slightly nuclear event. When Mr. Van de Graaff first built, oh, was it Mr. Cockcroft Walton, when he built that very high voltage generator.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
By way of the millions of volts he was working with, which is a kind of particle accelerator, he was getting the threshold of some kinds of nuclear reactions. But the apparatus that we've seen in these videos doesn't have those resources. So, how is it making that energy if it really is? And I know that you're in the process of duplicating what you believe is the best of the experiments you've researched. And when you did see the 27 seconds of decay on the Geiger counter, it would have been very interesting during that 20-second decay to pick up the Geiger counter, wave it around, and find out what was doing the 27 seconds of decay. Was it angular sensitive? If the Geiger counter is coming down in 27 seconds to normal, and it does that whether you aim it toward the apparatus or aim it away, in that particular experiment, if that's what would happen, that would indicate that something funny is going on inside the Geiger counter and is not necessarily measuring some kind of an event in the outside world through the Geiger counter.
KQ2QIQ with a comment.
Yeah, go ahead, Glenn.
A really good rad meter. I mean, I use them every day. They have sample times, because in other words, they're measuring, like, let's say if you're measuring millirems per hour, millirems per age, there's usually a setting on a rad meter that will usually set it up for sample rate. So a typical good stable sampling rate, when you find a good location, like if you're looking at an X-ray or something of that nature, and you want to zoom in on, get the, look right at the beam or right where it's, where the energy is coming from, you kind of put it on and you hold it on. But if you shut off the source instantaneously, like if you kill the voltage or kill anything to stop the source immediately, you're going to see a ramp down. But that's not the ramp down of the energy. What you're really looking at is the ramp down of the sampling of the rad meter. But here again, just a little bit of experience. KQ2QIQ.
Of the rad meters you have used, Glenn, even in the most long integration time setting, what roughly was the time constant that you've seen of the fall off? Did it fall off in 2 seconds, 20 seconds, 2 minutes? What have you seen as the maximum fall off time on some of the settings of the rad meters you've used? Over to you, Glenn, K2RIW.
Well, if I'm going to do a rad scan on like an X-ray monoblock, typically I'll set up the rad scan meter for about 14 seconds. It's just because generally if I put on the lead suit and the mask and all the other good stuff and hook the sensor up on the wand and get inside there with backup measurement meters and everything else, these are experiments that, and you want to be monitored all the time too with an exposure device on your lab coat to make sure you're not radiating yourself over time. But, I typically set these meters for about 14 seconds to get stable measurements. And these are ones you have to move very, very slowly to find out where the hot spots are. So in other words, whenever you're measuring a spot, to looking for leakage and things of that nature, you always want to move them very, very slowly. In other words, you don't want to go whipping this thing across looking for a hot spot. You got to move it very, very carefully and slow and see if you can find any, hot spot areas. So, a comfortable measurement that I like, that I usually depend on, is about 14 seconds, Dick.
Glenn, what was the actual thing that you were measuring? Was it an X-ray machine and you're looking for leakage in funny directions out of the machine? Or was it really nuclear materials that you were testing on the quality of the shielding of those nuclear materials? What were you actually measuring, Glenn, if you're allowed to tell us? KQ2QIQ, K2RIW.
X-ray monoblocks. Basically, they're all covered over with lead and everything else, but in other words, the X-ray port where the tube output would come from. But generally, you're measuring around the outside of the case and things so that there's no leakage, coming out the side, the lead-covered areas. So, you want to make sure that these things aren't, when they go into their final application, like an X-ray machine or something else, that the port is the only area that's exposing the X-rays, that they're not coming outside the ports in cooling areas where there are control signal ports with, control cables coming in and out. You want to make sure there's no leakage anywhere around the outside.
In the measurements you were doing, Glenn, were you doing a design verification test procedure, or were you the final testing department that was testing every one of the serial numbers that goes out to make sure that each one doesn't have something funny going on? And these X-ray blocks, was this for a medical X-ray machine? Over to you, Glenn, K2RIW.
Yeah, actually, I'm sometimes responsible for going into a lead room, and because we normally have monitors inside there when we're doing design and development on these things, and we have to sometimes go in and make the measurements in design and development because there's a lot of plumbing involved with these. So when you're doing a design, this is not just something you can do on paper. So there's a lot of lab time involved as well.
Okay, before I turn it back to Wes, anyone else have any further questions? comment on what you've heard so far. This is the more serious section of the Limark TechNet. K2RIW listening. Okay, no further questions or comments. You're in the process of building or have already built and are in process of refining one of these pieces of apparatus, Wes, and you started making some measurements. Is there further tuning you intend to do? Is there further production you intend to do? Is there further gathering of raw materials? Is there further gathering of test equipment? If you want to, you could, I'm asking the question, where do you stand right now in the procedure you intend to follow? And have you started getting results? When do you think you'll have a set of measurements? And when do you think you'll have enough test equipment to keep everybody happy? Well, that's a tough one. You never have enough test equipment. But when do you think you will have enough test equipment to almost make you satisfied? Over to you, Wes. Enter-XJN, K2RIW.
Enter-XJN. Well, the experiment is not being done only in one place. There are quite a good few guys, really smart brains. And I'm only one that is playing with this subject. For me, at least because we spoke just not long time ago, and we decided that since I don't have everything for me, and at the same time there is a need to confirm my findings, but you other guys, they are doing that. So you better consider these guys crazy, because some of them, they have a really good jobs in the universities, and they feel very much comfortable. But of course, after the hours, they do something that they don't really want to expose to the university bodies, as they don't want to lose the job or just be somehow, you know, it's hard even to use the word. But these guys are really serious of what they're doing. I've got what I've got. I see the confirmation. I'm going to do a few more projects in this area. I cannot really go further with letting up. The formal is 3CaPO3, which represents the calcium metaphosphate, and C is a coal. So the metaphosphate calcium may also be the calcium phosphate. And there is a very simple formula when you have one part of CaNO3, which would be the cobalt nitrate. And then you mix it with the calcium chloride, and then you put a few other ingredients into it, and you got what you got. I see the reaction after the radio wave is not there. Also, the frequency of the radio wave does not correspond with the reaction pattern of the compound. Let me go. So that is like, maybe I could use anything. At the time of Hundershot, 1926, the document says that Hundershot device works the best nearby vicinity of strong radio station. Then I look at the Army Fort Mammoth experiments, also the radio waves, and they specify the frequencies. 555 megahertz and 300, I believe, 30 something. Well, the original, the frequency of Coleman is 300. The frequency that I will use was 400 and change. It was in the ham radio band, which I'm entitled to use for the purpose of experimenting. So, If it's nothing gonna be there from that, that's fine. Guys, you're gonna be waking up tomorrow and having your headache with Wesley. But if it's different, Then we're talking about big change. Something must happen. It cannot be this way. The pollution, the contamination, and the lack of resources will be very much evident. Some say, hey, United States is not in danger, we have the resources. Well, yes. What about other countries? If they don't have the resources, how then the political situation would be? Well, yes, we are crazy. We're not looking for the money. I mean, I have nothing against the money. I would love to have plenty of money because of the job that I'm doing. But actually, I don't have to. I don't care. Enter it here.
Of the experiments that are quietly going on in universities and the experiments that you're going to be doing and your friends are going to be doing, is there a way of making a guess as to will it be a month from now, 6 months from now, or a year from now, in which they will be able to come to a conclusion as to whether or not the process has merit? The fact that a demonstration took place where the person doing the demonstration withheld a lot of information about raw ingredients and method, and claims that he's doing that in order to have intellectual property control, that he wants to, for whatever reason, he thinks what he's got is not patentable, therefore the only way he can keep control is to keep a secret. Well, a person making that claim might be honest, might not be honest. There's no easy way of telling. There's too much missing information. So, of all the parallel efforts that you know of going on, is there a guess, Wes, as to which one of those parallel efforts are likely to be able to come to a conclusion? And the main question we all are asking is this real? Is there really a significant amount of energy that can be produced under reproducible conditions? Not just a secret ingredient of somebody giving a demonstration. It's fun to look at those demonstrations, but they're a little bit... But they're a little bit frustrating to a person who wants to see quantitative data. Yeah, you can be told, I'm using X number of milligrams of nickel and Y number of milligrams of compressed hydrogen and maybe Z milligrams of some other ingredient. And then for hours, weeks, months, I'm going to get kilowatts of energy out of that with no further ingredients required. An extremely attractive sounding claim, if it's real. You have a guess as to how soon one of the parallel efforts are likely to come to a conclusion that there really is something here. And I know that if they find out that something is not there, then of course I'm a little bit afraid the claim will be, well, I didn't find out what the missing ingredient was. Therefore, I don't have the real experiment. I think Mr. Rossi said he's going to make 100,000 or a couple of 100,000 of these. I think he's saying within the next year or two. That would lead you to believe that we're likely to have an answer in a year or two. And by the way, if he starts selling them, and if he's so worried about control of intellectual property, if he starts selling 100,000 of these, even if it's a rental, when you put that many pieces of hardware, you put that many pieces of hardware out into the American public, no matter how strong a steel box you put it into, or a titanium box, or whatever, when there's 100,000 of them out there, somebody is going to do a reverse engineering. Somebody's going to open the lid and find out what's inside. So his ability to hold control of his intellectual property, if he doesn't have a patent, is going to be very difficult. Sounds to me it's not possible. If you had one out there and it's going to a person that you really trust, yes, he's not going to open the box. But you put 100,000 of them out there, and 15 of those people are going to open the box and see what's inside. It's
so the secret will be out. But once again, you might not know, but do you have a guess as to when one of the parallel efforts might be able to start to come to a conclusion? Is it real? N2XJN, KQLIW.
I think a few of the listeners might hold the breath right now, because a listener might be delusional. I was called a few years ago by one of the members of the Lightmark, or maybe not. The thing is that I started that mess, all of that, only a few days ago. From a few days ago till now, we have about 600,000 people that are pretty much interested in trying, and we have at least 12 individuals that have resources, money, well, it's not required money. The thing is, what is required is not no greed, which I understand some of you may laugh at me. I don't care. I want to just change the way that the world goes. This is my idea. This is my wish. No contamination. And no pay for the energy. Is it going to happen? I don't know. It's only, 5 days? 7 days? It's 30th of last month. It was the first time when I approached the subject. Rossi came to the picture only a few days ago because they found similarity to it. Now, Rossi, yes, he applied for the patent. I don't know if he's got a patent because I wasn't interested. But if he does, he's going to lose the patent right because I'm going to prove that he's using a common formula for it. The Rossi is only the runaway of it. It's just the thermal extraction. I'm not in.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Sorry about it. I don't make much of the secrets of it. Well, the copper, when it's oxide, it has extremely big resistance. The same as the zinc. So now, that should be some sort of the detective work or the reverse engineer to somebody who is not alive any longer, whose pattern happened to be so complete that I was able to work with it and get to the same result. I have to find out what it is, the granule composition of the zinc and copper, just to have conductivity. But I remember the friend who was at my house, he said, Wesley, this is the magic of what I will take. You got it. Enter Adrian.
Did you say magic of photovoltaic? Is that the word that you just said, Wes? Go ahead.
Photovoltaic. You got it. He was witnessing that. This guy is not naturally stupid guy. And John knows who I'm talking about, but I don't want to expose it in here. This is not the place for it. Enter Adrian.
Yes, I think I'm missing a word. Did you say photovoltaic or beta, B-E-T-A? Beta voltaic, is that what you said?
Beta, yes.
Okay, John, go ahead and say what you said, John.
No, I just iterated beta, not photo.
Okay. John, from your understanding, if you're going to give a definition of beta voltaic, what do you believe that means?
We create beta particles. They create voltage. That's the way I look at it. Seems simple.
This alternative energy technology, the promise extended by the life, that particular by the life, about 30 to 100 years, beta voltaic is used to generate electrical current in form of the battery. photovoltaics, but not all of them use radioactive source, which I don't. Beta voltaic is safer than microwave, concentrated microwave, when properly shielded. In plenty, I understand that you disagree with me, but in plenty of sources I found information that beta voltaic, when properly put into the box, is completely not harmful. And that's why beta voltaic is being used for the peacemakers, for the heart simulators. Andrea.
Okay. I thought a pacemaker, in many cases, consists of a lithium battery and a series of electronics that recognizes when the heartbeat has a missing beat, and it substitutes the missing beat. Is my understanding of a pacemaker. I think you said that is beta voltaic. I thought that was a somewhat conventional battery.
Dick, early ones didn't use lithium ion batteries. The early ones from a long time ago.
Go ahead, Glenn. What did the early ones use for batteries? And if you had to give a definition of beta voltaic, what would that definition be, Glenn? KCQQIQ, K2LIW?
In the earlier years, some medical devices actually used to use very, very primitive nuclear materials in a semiconductor type of approach. So in other words, they were kind of like self-powering transistors that generated output voltage from a piece of nuclear material. I think they were like something similar to like a uranium-tritium mix that kind of made a semiconductor constant output voltage. And they would last for a long period of time, but they were also very heavy, lead shielded, and they also had to be worn in what they made like pockets. In other words, they would cut like an incision in the skin and make a pocket so that this device could slip in. It was partially attached. They were really ugly. I mean, nothing like today's pacemakers.
That's true. Some of them yes, some of them not. I'm trying to find the article right now, which stands about miniature beta voltaic, and also the new article that I found, which is The Science, the Nanonuclear Batteries, by Park Folsom, worth of reading. It's a recent stuff, and it shows the beta voltaic, how it works, and of course the application. And it's extremely small one, very much contained. Not harmful, also useful, the peacemakers. And so
it's lithium, Dick.
If I was designing a pacemaker, I would like to be able to have some kind of a power supply on board that requires no change of the power supply for, let me pick a number, 10 years. So maybe nuclear-like materials were used in some of these earlier designs, if I understand correctly, Glenn, to try to make a very long-lasting battery. And the good news about a nuclear power supply like is on Curiosity right now is it can give some pretty nice amounts of power, not necessarily compact, but for very long periods of time. That's the good news. Shielding the human being from the undesired radiation is one thing to worry about. Shielding the electronics. No matter how hardened your electronics is, if it's being irradiated with nuclear particles, it's only a matter of time before it has a certain failure rate. So I'm getting the guess, Glenn, I'm not really up on pacemakers, but apparently you've heard more about them than I have, and I have the impression that our design philosophy of them has changed over the years. We've gotten better on more conventional batteries, and the nuclear-like supplies, I am guessing, are less favorable. What's your guesses on my part? KC2QIQ, K2RIW, I'm the tech man.
Jay, before you start, I found nanopower beta voltaic microbatteries by Sonic MES Laboratory. I've got self-reproductive radioisotope power cantilever. All of them are new. 2012, 2009, 2011, 2004. Nuclear energy conversion. This one is old, 1978. but most of them are pretty much not much new interaction.
Wes, you should back away from that microphone a little bit. You're so close, you are doing some distortion. Glenn, go ahead.
Like Leslie's saying, they've been around a while. I mean, these things are nothing new, but they were hazardous. And then, of course, they're just like everything else. When they reach a certain age, you know, after 10 years or so, now they become waste, and they have to be handled separately. Where today, the technology going through lithium-ion batteries, they last about the same time. The real difference is the electronics have been greatly improved and shrunk down in size. So they have devices today that a doctor can set over the telephone through, like, a telephone connection and change the rate of the pacemakers. I mean, they've come a long, long, long way in medical technology in that area. So you can't compare the, you know, those old, you know, beta voltaics. Heck, I think beta voltaics have been commercially produced as far back as, well, this is 20, so yeah, probably since 1960s, they've been in commercial production. So they've been around a long time. But you don't see them in much, even many medical applications anymore, probably for at least 30 years. So, you know, they're hazardous.
I got a question though for you, Glenn. And that is, did the beta voltaic-like pacemakers of 10, 20 years ago, was there concern that the beta emission could potentially damage the electronics some number of years downrange? Was there a concern along those lines, Glenn? Over to you, Glenn, K2RAW.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, these things were like lead-lined cases, you know, so you not only had, you know, I mean, you've seen what goes into, like, a detector for, like, smoke detectors and things like that, little pieces that go in there, and then they get, well, you know, it was, you know, similar kind of technology. You have that, and then you have lead lining, and then, of course, then you have the other problem, is that the lead itself is poisonous, and you're putting that in the body, so it's like, there aren't too many metals you really want inside your body, so that's only part of the issue. Yeah, and the electronics are always an issue, but I think the biggest problem was the lead.
And I guess the sheer size of it made it a massive operation, a bulge on the body, and so unless your cardiac condition was pretty severe, you wouldn't easily elect to do this in those days. Is that true, Glenn?
Yeah, absolutely, and beside the number of cardiologists that were trained back then, it was just that was like a new technology back then. You know, you're talking about, you know, in the 1960s, pacemakers, you know, if you were, you probably would have had to have had extremely good medical coverage at that time, and then try to find a cardiologist and a surgeon, a heart surgeon that probably knew how to use one properly, you know, was not as common as it is today. Today the technology has come so far that I think, you know, before a surgeon makes it out of, you know, makes it into their first year in a hospital, they are well-versed in the latest technologies of modern pacemakers today.
And we better do a little bit of a sign-off here. Let me drop. At midnight, this machine is going to be cut off. You've listened to TechNet 1444. It might be 1,445. I could be at least one wrong in the number. We'll be back next week, and be kind to each other. John, I bet you you've got more of those pieces of mail coming with more of these guys doing these crazy experiments. Is that true, John? KC2WGB, K2RAW.
Yes, I do, Dick. It slowed down a little bit, but there's still a few questions. But we'll bring them up next week, and I wish everybody luck, and have fun, and relax. Ham radio is supposed to be a hobby of fun. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Thank you very much, Glenn. Thank you very much, Dick, and John, and everybody, for tonight's beautiful evening spent with you. Thank you.
Bye-bye, you all. And yes, as Jerry and others say, this is supposed to be fun. This is a hobby. We're doing this for the enjoyment. Try to enjoy it. Be kind to each other. Bye-bye for now.
Once again, our thanks from Toronto, Canada. for another great nap. Be easy. Peace out.
Go ahead, Scott. Thanks for joining. KC2WGB.
K2RIW, K2JHR. Can I meet you on the UHF side? I have a question for you.
KHR, you want to go over to the UHF frequency?
Affirmative. I have an EMP shielding question.
Roger.
The time is 12 a.m. 73 and good night from the WQVL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the WQVL repeater.
See you there, I'll try.